This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today, we're talking about how we remember, understand, and commemorate history. We'll talk about how one Indiana town has wrestled with these exact questions in light of a recently declared Founders Day. Joining me now is Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Charlie Savage. Charlie is a Washington correspondent for the New York Times, and his recent piece, When the Culture Wars Hit Fort Wayne, was published earlier this month by Politico. Charlie, it's great to have you with us today.
Thanks for having me.
So let's first rewind to February 2019, which feels like 400 years ago. We're in your hometown of Fort Wayne at a city council meeting, and a resolution is proposed to annually celebrate General Mad Anthony Wayne Day. Can you tell us first, I guess, who General Anthony Wayne was?
Absolutely. So Mad Anthony Wayne, the namesake of my hometown of Fort Wayne, as you mentioned, was an early American military leader. He was a general under George Washington in the Revolutionary War, and then he returned to the military in the early 1790s when George Washington assigned him to build a new army to replace one that had been destroyed by Native Americans and go into the Northwest Territory to try to complete a mission that previous generals had failed to do, which is to punish into submission and pacify the Great Lakes area tribes of the Northwest Territory who had been fighting with white settlers spreading down the Ohio River.
And so then who proposed this idea of a Founders Day?
Jason Arp is a city councilman in Fort Wayne, one of nine members. He's a Republican, but I would say more of a Tea Party or style Republican than some on the council. And it was he who had the idea of creating a new local holiday in Fort Wayne to honor General Wayne for his contributions to American history, including the military conquest of Native Americans that opened what we now call the Midwest to white settlement.
So can you describe the pitch that he gave? How was it historically presented?
He put forward a PowerPoint presentation in favor of this idea, and it's online. You can go look at it if you want on the Fort Wayne City Council's website, in which he portrayed General Wayne as essentially a role model and a hero of American history. He claimed that during the Revolutionary War, General Wayne had led a charge that prevented the British military from capturing George Washington after the traitor Benedict Arnold had revealed his location and suggested that had the British succeeded in capturing Washington, the war would have been lost. So that we have Anthony Wayne to thank in Arp's telling for the fact that we even have a United States of America. And turning to the portions of the Northwest Indian War, he presented a very positive, a flattering portrait of Wayne's deeds, omitting some negative aspects, maybe from the perspective of modern eyes of how he treated the Native Americans and suggesting that they had been British led anyway, which reframed the conflict from one between an invader and a defender to a struggle between two factions of white people who were both far from home.
And so a city having a Founders Day is a pretty common thing, but what was the impetus to create one in 2019? What's the why here?
Well, a couple years earlier, a lawyer in Fort Wayne named Michael Loomis had read something, I'm not sure if it was a book or what, about Wayne's deeds in the Revolutionary War and thought that it was odd that we had this relatively famous for his time, although largely forgotten in the specifics, I think, in the modern era, person that the city had all these ties to, not just for his deeds in the Northwest Indian War, but who had achieved prominence even in the Revolutionary War, and yet that there was not a Founders Day in the city. There was not a way in which the civic event to commemorate and educate residents about this person. And so he pitched Michael Loomis, that is, Jason Arp in 2017 about the idea of creating a Wayne Day. And Arp explored it at that time, but it didn't get a lot of interest, and he never formally proposed it. And then in February of 2019, he abruptly revived the idea and put forward this resolution without, and Loomis told me later that he didn't even know it was happening, didn't see the text of the resolution ahead of time, only found out a couple hours before the meeting that there was something going on with his idea, not inside ARP's head, but it is notable that at that point, his term was almost up. He was facing re-election, and he had drawn a challenger in the Republican primary who assembled several notable endorsements, a more mainstream Republican challenger. And so it was a time when Jason Arp needed to get attention and be at the forefront of something as part of running for re-election. Whether or not that was the impetus for that timing, I can't say.
What was the council's initial reaction to the proposal?
So it immediately prompted a debate on the council. An African-American councilman named Glenn Hines immediately spoke up in objection to it. He portrayed the context of Wayne's deeds as the genocide of Native Americans. He pointed out that some members of the Miami tribe, which used to live in Fort Wayne and before it was removed to the far west a couple generations after Wayne's conquest, still had some members in Indiana, and they might be offended by this and said he would vote against it. Other members thought it might be made more sense, that it was interesting, that we can't judge the deeds of people in the past by today's moral standards. That's an incorrect way of thinking about historical heroes and villains and significant figures, and that the city should proceed with this. And still other members of the council were cautious and wanted to delay voting. But Jason Arp insisted on voting right away, and he raised the stakes by suggesting that to fail to support Wayne Day would mean you were not a patriotic American, that you were anti-American. And so the council swiftly voted 6-3 to create Wayne Day.
Hmm. You grew up in Fort Wayne. You describe it as being, quote, saturated in references to Anthony Wayne and the Native Americans he fought. What did you mean by that?
Well, the name of Wayne and the name of the names of the tribes, especially the Miami, Shawnee, and others, and their chiefs like Little Turtle, Tecumseh of the Shawnee, and so forth, are all over the place in Fort Wayne. They're the names of summer camps, library branches, streets. I mentioned the story that when I was growing up in Fort Wayne, I opened my first bank account at Anthony Wayne Bank, which was across Anthony Boulevard from Atsis Ice Cream Shop, which sold gigantic Mad Anthony sundaes, as well as smaller turtle sundaes, not unlike Little Turtle. And so the names of the people from and events of that era are a constant background noise in Fort Wayne. And yet at the same time, growing up there, my experience was there was very little discussion about who these people actually were, what they had actually done. It was just taken for granted that these were the names of things without much engagement about what was behind those words.
So did you feel like you really didn't have a full understanding of the city's history, I guess?
Certainly growing up, I did not. I had started to get interested in Midwestern history, coincidentally, a few months before this, and started reading up on it just for my own interest. And that may have been why my interest in this culture war fight that broke out in Fort Wayne over the creation of Wayne Day, why it appealed to me so much, why it piqued my interest. And then I went much, much deeper in the course of the year of reporting out this article, reading many, many books of history, talking to many historians, reading many primary documents, both to understand what I was looking at and to understand a debate that broke out in Fort Wayne and an aspect of the debate, which was whether the city council had gotten the facts garbled, whether it had presented a whitewashed or sanitized portrait of history. To evaluate that, I had to really learn it myself. And I found it fascinating in and of itself, a really vivid story about how the Midwest and came to be what it is today and Fort Wayne's role in that. But also striking because it became clear to me that my exposure to it as just a kid growing up and going to public school in Fort Wayne had been quite sanitized. I had been presented with a very watered down or sort of gauzy, feel good, maybe mythic version of what happened to the extent it was discussed at all. And there's a lot of things that just weren't discussed at all to a very surprising degree, given how interesting the history turned out to be.
Let's get into some of it. Before the city of Fort Wayne was under American control, it belonged to the Miami tribe. You write that the territory flourished for most of the 18th century. What made the whole area prosperous?
So Fort Wayne is in a very special spot topographically, geologically, which is that it is right on top of a continental divide left behind by the glacier that melted back into Lake Erie 20,000 years ago. And that causes rainwater to flow to the ocean in opposite directions. And so you have the beginning of the St. Lawrence Seaway network going to the north and east of Fort Wayne, primarily along the Maumee River, which forms in Fort Wayne and flows into Lake Erie. And then on a few miles away, you have a tributary called the Little River to the Wabash, which flows into the Ohio and then into the Mississippi and all the way down Louisiana and out to New Orleans. And so there were these two gigantic water networks through the continent's interior. And Fort Wayne sat atop, or what is now Fort Wayne, sat atop the shortest overland land portage between the two. So that in the era of French and then British fur traders and early explorers and missionaries and just Algonquin tribes doing their own thing without regard to European who were showing up, that spot was a hub or a crossroads of tremendous importance. It was, and controlling it was made the Miami tribe that was based there. In a cluster of villages, usually called Kikianga, both cosmopolitan and wealthy because of all the trade and traffic that was going through this land portage that they controlled. And so they, throughout the 1700s, were there, and it became, because of this crossroads hub-like nature, it then further evolved into the military headquarters of a multi-tribal alliance, which white people sometimes call the Western Confederacy, which battled the young United States, white America, for control of the Northwest Territory after the Revolutionary War had ended and white people started spreading into what is now places like Ohio and Kentucky.
We'll be back with journalist Charlie Savage after a quick break. We're talking about his recent piece, When the Culture Wars Hit Fort Wayne. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're talking about how we remember and commemorate history. Specifically, we're talking about the piece that recently ran in Politico by Charlie Savage called When the Culture Wars Hit Fort Wayne. And we are joined again by Charlie Savage. And just before we went to the break, we were talking about what made the area prosperous. And it had a lot to do with the sort of, it had a lot to do with geology. You had the Wabash to the south, flowing south. You had the Maumee flowing north to Lake Erie, and disputes over the territory escalated as Americans continued to move west. And by 1785, the Northwest Indian War was underway, and there's a series of efforts to try to capture the future Fort Wayne, Kikianga. Can you tell us about those early efforts?
A precursor to this is that the British government had been preventing white land speculators and would-be settlers from flowing into the Northwest Territory because they wanted to keep the peace in the continent. And so after the Revolutionary War ends, a piece of that is that the British, as part of the peace treaty, say, okay, you, the United States, can take over our claim to the Northwest Territory. That's the area north and west of the Ohio River, what is today Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Michigan, and Wisconsin. But the Native American nations who already lived there, of course, were not part of that treaty, and they owned the land and were on it and had not ceded it. And so you have this complicated situation where white settlers are flowing down the Ohio River and carving out homesteads on land they had no clear right to be on. And so the tribes start attacking these settlers, trying to drive them back across the Appalachian Mountains. They recognize that the rapidly growing number of white intruders, squatters from their point of view, posed an existential threat to their own survival as a people, which turned out to be correct. And they refused to even meet to discuss a treaty to sell off their lands. And so to change that attitude, the George Washington administration decides to go crush them, essentially, by sending a military force to their de facto capital, which is Kikianga, the area that is now Fort Wayne, to burn down all their homes and burn all of their crops and winter food. That is explicitly the policy. So the first such expedition was in 1790. First one by General Harmer does reach Kikianga. Then civilians flee. Harmer's men burn down all the homes, the wigwams and log cabins, and burn all the winter food. But then Little Turtle and his warriors counterattack, and Harmer's men flee in disarray, the survivors at least. And so it goes down as Harmer's defeat. The next year, a second general, Arthur St. Clair, tries again. And before he can even get that far, the Western Confederacy, led by people like Little Turtle and Blue Jacket of the Shawnee, launch a surprise attack on his camp in what is now the small town of Fort Recovery, Ohio, just across the border. And they essentially annihilate the army of St. Clair. It's the largest, most lopsided defeat in the frontier war history. The tribal alliance is only emboldened rather than chastened. And then President Washington decides to launch a third invasion. And this time he turns to General Wayne.
And so why did he pick General Wayne, and how does that unfold?
General Wayne had worked for Washington in the Revolutionary War, so they knew each other. But it was, I think it was also somewhat the least bad option. Wayne had been a total failure in private life after the Revolutionary War had ended. He had essentially abandoned his wife and developed a scandalous reputation with other women. He'd been given a farm in Georgia as a thank you. He was from Pennsylvania by the people down there for driving out the British, or helping do so late in the war. He decided to start a plantation. He borrowed a ton of money to buy slaves with, but he could not make a go of it, even with all that free labor. And he wasn't able to pay off the loan either. He was sort of a financial ruin as a result. And then he got himself elected to Congress from Georgia, and then he was ousted from Congress because it turned out he was elected through voter fraud. And so he's a complete personal and political disgrace, financial ruin at this moment. But George Washington needs someone, and it's Wayne he turns to, and he says, build me a new legion and go try to succeed where Generals Harmer and St. Clair had failed.
And so then there was the Battle of Fallen Timbers, tough winter, a treaty to enter the war is signed. What was the deal?
Right. So Wayne is, for all of his failures in private life, he is at his tactical level an excellent general. He trains his men much better than the other predecessors did to fight a guerrilla war battle in the wilderness. He builds forts all the way up from Cincinnati to protect his supply lines and prevent the kind of sudden attack that wrecked St. Clair. In fact, he builds Fort Recovery, which is a pregnant name, on the site of St. Clair's defeat, where there were skeletons all over the place from the massacre. And when he reaches the Maumee River, he is eventually attacked by the Western Confederacy, but his troops are able to rout them. And he goes and kind of rattles his saber a little bit at a British fort near modern-day Toledo after defeating the tribal warriors in battle. But then he turns and marches upstream, burning systematically all the evacuated tribal villages and fields and winter food stores for the Native Americans along the riverfront, which was basically one continuous town for 50 miles or so, until he reaches the headwaters of the Maumee, that is today modern-day Fort Wayne, where Kikianga is still in ruins from Harmer's attack. And there he has his men build a fort to occupy the heart of the tribal territory, the former military headquarters, as I've mentioned, of the tribal resistance. And then the fall of 1794, difficult winter ensues for the Native Americans. They have no homes, they have no food stores, and it breaks their resistance. And the next, early the next year, he negotiates, or more or less imposes, a treaty upon them in which they are agree to give up what is most of today the state of Ohio, as well as key tracts further west, including around downtown Fort Wayne, which includes their former capital of Kikianga, and the future downtowns of Detroit and Chicago. And Wayne promises them that the rest of the Northwest Territory will remain theirs forever, and that's where the state name Indiana comes from, because it was to be the Indiana Territory, the land of the Indians, though, of course, that didn't last much longer.
And so that brings us to present day. The proposal for Wayne Day was passed, and then a retired pastor named John Gardner wrote a column that was published in the Fort Wayne Journal Gazette criticizing that resolution. And, you know, we just heard a lot of the history. A lot of what some would consider atrocities took place. What was John Gardner's, what were his concerns?
Well, the resolution didn't really lay out what happened as I have here. The resolution suggested that, and Jason Arp's presentation in support of the resolution suggested that Wayne had been merciful to the Native Americans and that they had been, as I mentioned earlier, British-led anyway. You know, there's no evidence they ever subordinated themselves to white command. And it really glossed over a lot of the key detail, like why was this war happening in the first place? And, you know, what happened to the natives afterwards? You know, they rapidly went in, even though Wayne himself died, they rapidly went into decline. They were kind of wrecked by alcoholism as white traders came to sell them alcohol to exchange for the money that they got every year at Fort Wayne under the treaty. And they ran up debts and were the government leveraged them to keep selling off more and more of the reservation land. And then the tribes were removed in the first part and the middle part of the 19th century, sent out west. And so the whole thing was a catastrophe for them, of course. And so the resolution didn't get into any of that. The pastor you mentioned didn't like the idea in the first place. He told me before he even knew this history, he just thought the notion that seemed to kind of like a white nationalist move. He's obviously a very liberal person. Then he read a biography of Wayne and learned some of the facts we'd been discussing. And he was really furious and wrote this editorial in the Journal Gazette in Fort Wayne that really was the first time a lot of people in Fort Wayne had been exposed to some ugly truths about Anthony Wayne. And then on top of that, then, the Miami tribe of Oklahoma, the former inhabitants of what is now Fort Wayne, also learned of this. They still have some members in Indiana and were very upset and reached out to the city to express their concerns.
And at this point, how is the public discourse shaping up around Wayne Day?
We're now in the sort of April, May, June timeframe of last year. It's clear there's a back and forth emerging. There, it looks for a while like there's a push for the city council to rescind Wayne Day, rescind the resolution, rework it, maybe not necessarily get rid of the idea of having a Founders Day, but at least have it be historically accurate and complete. Even the conservative editorial board of the New Sentinel portrays the resolution as unnecessarily provocative and unnecessary, and this calls for it to be rescinded. On the other hand, there's the people who support Wayne Day, who are not all political. There's Jason Arp, who is very political, of course, but he's working with Michael Loomis, who I mentioned earlier, who's more, I think, a history buff who's just interested in the events and wanting to have a day to help Fort Wayne residents learn more about their past without regard to necessarily taking sides in the matter, are pushing forward with planning. And they accuse the critics of hysteria and are fairly dug in. And it's clear that notwithstanding the request from the Miami tribe that the city council take another look at it, consult the Fort Wayne History Center, get its facts straight, there's no political appetite at that moment to revisit the matter. And Jason Arp wins his primary resoundingly gets a Republican nomination for another term, in part pretty clearly because he was coasting on a wave of publicity about this. And there was certainly a faction of people in Fort Wayne who also fully aware of now of the more complicated events surrounding the establishment of the fort and the Northwest Indian War are nevertheless wanting to celebrate it. They join Jason Arp in saying this is a matter of patriotism and we should be allowed as white Americans to be a little bit triumphalist about this rather than being self-flagellatory about it.
And so July 16th, 2019 finally arrives, the first annual Wayne Day. What was the day like?
It was a hot day. It was muggy. There was about 60 people gathered at the statue of Anthony Wayne in downtown Fort Wayne. Jason Arp told me later he had been worried there would be protesters, especially because he was bringing his family. But there were no protesters. And the people who didn't like it were shunning it rather than showing up to complain about it in person. And Jason Arp gave a very interesting speech in which was much more accurate than his original resolution, which he had refused to concede error about. He still didn't mention that Wayne had owned slaves and certain things like that, but he mentioned that he had had financial troubles and had been ousted from Congress and so forth. And so it was a more three-dimensional portrait. I should jump in here, though, to say we're missing an important part of the story, which is after all this had happened and people continued to be upset about it, someone graffitied the replica old fort in Fort Wayne with the phrase, "No pride in Native genocide," in August. Another city council member took efforts to try to mitigate the situation, a guy named Jeff Paddock, who had actually voted for the resolution back in February. He worked with the Miami tribe and historians to put together a corrective resolution that acknowledged many of the historical errors in the original resolution and omissions and in the presentation that Jason Arp had put together about it. It didn't address the erroneous portrait of the Revolutionary War battle we talked about, where Jason Arp had claimed that Wayne had saved George Washington from being captured after Benedict Arnold's treason. None of that is true. It came from a television show called Turn Washington Spies. Anyway, this resolution didn't fix that problem, but it did address the problems with the account of the Northwest Indian War. And the Miami tribe did say that they were satisfied with that. And so that does not remove Wayne Day. But when the city council passed that 8-1 with only Jason Arp voting against, it did reduce some of the frictions surrounding the existence of this new local holiday.
And so I guess stepping back a bit to wrap things up, I mean, this story captures just one city's struggle with conversations we're having at a national level. What did you take away from putting this piece together?
I was originally attracted to it because it seemed to provide a lens for thinking about these struggles we're all having nationally with how to engage with aspects of our shared past that are maybe look uglier when the full truth of them are told. But that doesn't mean that we want to forget them either. And obviously in 2020, after the George Floyd Black Lives Matter protests have grown into this larger moment of historical reappraisal, that hadn't happened yet when I started digging into this. But certainly for years now, we've been having foreshadowing that this is a difficult question raised by the presence of Confederate Civil War monuments and frictions over things like Washington Redskins name and the former Northside High School Fort Wayne Redskins, for that matter, and other things that were inherited that maybe look different in today's light. And I'm sympathetic even to people like Michael Loomis and to some extent even people like Jason Arp. I asked Jason Arp about aspects of this when he and I had a long breakfast, and when I pushed him, for example, on the notion that opposing Wayne Day or criticizing Anthony Wayne was anti-American, I suggested that some people would argue that you could love this country and be glad you're in it, but want it to be better and want to fully understand how we got here. And that means, looking at the past as it was and not whitewashing away things to turn what really happened into a feel-good myth, and engaging with things as they were three-dimensionally as grown-up right, as opposed to unpatriotic. And he told me he agreed with that, but also thought that when society is having civic days to celebrate important people from the past, it's appropriate to honor them in a sort of apple pie kind of way and not dwell on their failures, but rather, you know, dwell on the things we want to, you know, that we honor them for, which is means you don't have to necessarily bring up that Anthony Wayne owned slaves, or as he mentioned, Martin Luther King was unfaithful to his wife. Does that mean that we still honor him, but we honor him for his civil rights achievements, et cetera? I think that there's, you know, Wayne is particularly complicated figure from that lens, and that he was an important person in the American Revolution. But that said, the reason that he has gone down in history, his real contribution to American history, was the conquest of the Midwest, of the Native American tribes here, as sort of a second act 15 years after the Revolutionary War. And certainly that's why the city of Fort Wayne would be having a holiday for him. And I think we're still kind of grappling with the complexities of recognizing the cost to Native Americans that the creation of modern America entailed.
Charlie Savage is a Washington correspondent for the New York Times, and you can find his recent piece, When the Culture Wars Hit Fort Wayne, on Politico's website. Charlie, thanks again for taking the time to join us today.
Thank you. Thanks for drawing attention to it.
I'm Matt Pelser. We're back with the discussion. 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Back now to our discussion on how we remember, understand, and commemorate history. We are live for this segment, so we would love to hear your questions and comments. We're on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or you can leave us a short voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. 866-476-3881. We're joined now by three guests. Michelle M. Marino is the Deputy Director of the Indiana Historical Bureau. Michelle, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Cameron Shriver is an assistant professor of history at Miami University. Cameron Shriver, it's good to have you with us.
Thanks so much.
Diane Hunter is the tribal historic preservation officer of the Miami Tribe of Oklahoma. Diane Hunter, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Michelle, we've been talking today about the creation of Fort Wayne's Founders Day, a situation where history is interpreted differently by several groups of people. As a historian, is this something you come across often?
It is, and it's a really important discussion to have. And I think that's the one piece that I would want to highlight out of this, that history is a narrative that is composed of multiple perspectives. And to really understand history and how it's created and to have a more rich and diverse and sort of fuller picture of the past, you absolutely have to incorporate multiple perspectives.
I mean, do you think that there are misconceptions about what history actually is then?
Yeah, I absolutely do. And I think that gets to the heart of this issue, too, is that a lot of people don't actually understand what history is. They think it's just what happened in the past, and it's not. It's a story that's based on evidence that we have, that where we're trying to understand why things happened in the past. And those stories change over time based on new evidence, by incorporating new perspectives, by looking at things from a different angle. So again, like with the story and what's going on in Fort Wayne, you know, you look at Founders Day or you look at the history from Anthony Wayne's perspective, but you add in the perspective from the Miami Indians, that looks a lot different. It's also important to have that perspective. But I think people tend to bristle sometimes because they see history as being black and white and as static, and it's simply not. It's changing. It's, again, incorporating new evidence, new sources, and new perspectives.
Cameron, what are some of the challenges to getting history right and telling a comprehensive story?
Right. I totally agree with Michelle. We are all historians. I mean, our society is kind of full of historians. All of us interpret the past in our own ways. I think that this conversation is a real opportunity, as Michelle said, to think about historical literacy and what is history. One of the problems that, as a teacher of history in a university and thinking a lot about this and teaching future teachers, public school teachers or teachers, is that commemoration and patriotic versions of history are not necessarily history as historians understand it. In other words, if you tell a lionized version of Anthony Wayne, what do we do then with the perspectives, both of course, Miami, Shawnee, Delaware people who did not think that he was merciful, or from other American citizens who are really questioning this project of American invasion, of American empire building at the time, who were not great fans of Anthony Wayne or the type of tactics that he was employing. So there are all these multiple perspectives that if we draw a narrow narrative of history, it makes it difficult to incorporate those valid perspectives. It makes it confusing why people would disagree, both in the past and the present.
Diane Hunter, you're the Tribal Historic Preservation Officer of the Miami Tribe of Oklahoma. What are the challenges to preserving the history of the tribe?
I think Charlie explained very well the problems that most of us who grew up in Indiana experienced in terms of education related to Native peoples. And when we aren't taught in school, then we begin to believe that this isn't a people who exists anymore and maybe never was really important. And when people believe that we don't exist, then it's okay to tell their story the way they want to. And that's a challenge for us because it's our story, and we should be the ones to tell that story, or at least to include our perspective as the story is told.
Michelle, there's lots of debate as to how we should commemorate history, and especially this kind of history. I mean, can you talk about what that term means?
Yeah, and I think this also leads to some misunderstanding from the public, but there's a difference between commemoration and memorialization. And sort of as I see commemorate, this is to educate the public. This is to acknowledge history. This is to look into the past, and again, including those multiple perspectives, to better understand what happened here, what happened across the nation. So we also understand the present, because if you're not drawing a direct line from the past to today, you don't understand anything. So history is incredibly relevant. It's incredibly important. But again, I think we get confused by celebrating and memorializing as opposed to educating and better understanding. And I think that draws into this debate about monuments coming down and who we should honor. And again, whether that's honoring and memorializing versus educating and discussing and contextualizing.
And so going back to what Diane said, Michelle, that it's their story. It's the story of the Miami tribe. But it is also the story of Anthony Wayne as well, and his efforts, you know, for better or for worse. And I guess what we're talking about then is whether or not we commemorate that, knowing now what we know about what some would consider atrocities that were committed in our past. And so that's the conversation then.
Right. But there's a lot of things to sort of flush out in that, right? So I'm not saying that we don't have a Founders Day or we don't talk about this or we don't study this. But there's a difference between putting a statue up and hero worship without looking at the complexities of the man and his actions, or only having the singular story, whereas Diane's absolutely right. It's their story to tell. But throughout much of American history, that story has not been heard. It's been Wayne's version of history that's been out there. So, you know, I think we need to, look back at the full picture here, but then just have a real discussion about what this history is. What is it that we want to take and understand from it, and what that means from us today as well? And again, that gets into this, I think, real blurry lines about patriotism and memorialization versus, again, just talking about the past and understanding how that puts us also in the present.
We're talking today about how we remember, understand, and commemorate history through the lens of talking about Fort Wayne initiating a Founders Day last year and the complicated history behind that, and Fort Wayne's founder, Anthony Wayne, General Anthony Wayne. Diane Hunter, how do you view this question of how we should approach commemoration?
I think it is important to acknowledge all people who were involved in whatever piece of history we're discussing, and looking at different perspectives. No story is complete without looking at all the perspectives. Our Miami tribe perspective is not the only perspective. We understand that. But it's really important that our perspective be included. And by doing that, including the Miami tribe in that, so that somebody else from outside our tribe is not telling our story, but that they are engaging with the tribe so that we can work with them to tell our story ourselves.
Cameron Shriver, so many people who are against taking down monuments and things like that say that it is erasing history. And so some of the argument, I guess, for instituting this Founders Day in Fort Wayne was that this is history that needs to be remembered. We need to remember why we call this Fort Wayne. And now through the modern lens, with so many people seeing what he did as being so wrong, I don't know. How do we incorporate that? How do we bring back the stories of the Miami tribe, the stories that were just cast aside? How do we bring that back in along with everything that we already know and were taught about Anthony Wayne and about the founding of Fort Wayne as we know it now?
Right. So thinking about statues and other types of past commemorative landscapes that we're wrestling with is maybe not, as a historian, perhaps I don't think of a statue as history. I think of it as going back to a story, or it's a narrative about history and who was important and why. So to reframe kind of the question around education and we should remember Anthony Wayne, I think that's generally right. I think we should understand Wayne in this time period because he is an important character. We should try to understand this guy as a full human being, not necessarily a hero, but perhaps if the evidence leads us to that characterization, I think in this case it will not. But why did he do what he did? Why was he picked to lead this? How did he sleep at night? If this was truly an invasion that most of us would say, boy, that's morally dubious, well, how did he get over that? I think trying to understand these people as complex and full human beings, all people in the past, really gets us to the heart of the matter and helps us understand the past and what it should mean, what it can help us to understand in the present.
Michela, this raises the question of who gets to tell history. Why is it important to consider who is telling history and who should be at the table?
Sure. Well, and I think this gets back to the point that Cameron just mentioned as well, which is that a lot of people haven't been at the table in telling history over the course of history, if you will, that a lot of these stories have been left out of the historical narrative. And, you know, it's really not until the 1960s that, African-American history becomes a field, women's history, Native history. And so these stories have been left out of the narrative, and we want to make sure that they're included. But at the same time, it's about education, and it's about the ways in which we present this to the public and to children, and we're taught about what's important, and is it hero worship versus looking at the complexities of the human beings and this full story and full picture to better understand who we are and why people have done certain things and sort of the motives behind that and how that would have been contextualized at the time versus how we also feel about that now. And so I don't know that we've always done that particularly well in the field of history, but it's certainly moved in that direction over the course of the last few decades.
Cameron, why is so much of history, as so many people know it, hero worship? Is it just easier to tell that kind of story, or is it just more fun?
It might be some of that. You know, I'm thinking about the development of history as a profession and how it's been used in the last couple hundred, 150 years. And it really did develop as kind of a way to explain why nation states exist. So I wonder if our instinct as Americans or maybe Western society or just humans generally is to conflate history with celebrating our own kind of nation and supporting it. I suppose it helps some of us feel good, those of us who are telling our own stories and telling it in a positive way. But at the same time, by telling pretty narrow stories, which I think is not the case in a lot of segments of our society, by telling more vast stories, by telling larger stories, there's so many interesting stories that we can tell. I mean, I'm thinking of, you know, these Native men and women who are trying to decide, are Kentuckians in the 1790s, these are people who have had their villages destroyed, are starving, are saying we might need to surrender because we just literally have no food. But they're wondering, you know, are the Kentuckians really Americans? Because the Americans are saying, well, they're just Kentuckians. They're not really part of our national polity. They're people that we can't control. So who is this war against if you're a Miami or Shawnee person? Is it against the United States, or is it against just this offshoot called Kentuckians or Long Knives? In the same kind of village, they're literally hearing news of the Haitian Revolution in the early 1790s and trying to discuss that. So thinking about colonialism of these Native folks who are living in northern Indiana, thinking about colonialism in the Caribbean is a fascinating story that I think we could think through. So there are all these stories that these different perspectives help us to open up our minds about who is in our stories, who is part of our shared past.
Diane, how important is it to you that the people of the Miami tribe are involved in the telling of their own story?
It's vital. It is vital to us in part because what we have seen is when we were not included, our story doesn't get told, almost doesn't get told at all. But also when it is told, it's not told in a way that really tells our story, as Cam and Michelle have talked about. Our story isn't told, and it makes us a people of the past who are relegated to the past. But we are not a people of the past. We are a living people. The Miami Tribe of Oklahoma has about 5,500 citizens. 700 of us live in Indiana. And we're a sovereign nation, and we can tell our story. We appreciate the support that others give us the opportunity to provide education. But we ask that people talk to us before they tell our story, because we can tell our own story.
I want to thank all of our guests for taking the time today. Michelle Marino is the Deputy Director of the Indiana Historical Bureau. Michelle, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Cameron Shriver is Assistant Professor of History at Miami University. Thank you, Cam.
Thank you.
Diane Hunter is the Tribal Historic Preservation Officer of the Miami Tribe of Oklahoma. Thank you so much, Diane.
Thank you.